The automotive industry is under a huge secular shift, not only with the transition to electric vehicles, but even more importantly, the transition to autonomous vehicles. We see lots of players in the market out there, like Waymo and a number of other Chinese players, who are really trying to lead in the commercialization of this technology. But the amount of disruption that this has for the entire economy, not just in automotive, but in a number of other areas, has huge implications. And so in this great conversation with Sam Corris, we dig into what does the competition for autonomous vehicles look like for Chinese automakers, for legacy automakers in Europe, like BMW or Volkswagen, for example. We've got players here in the United States, but then we also have technology companies like Uber, who might potentially play a role in this transition. And we get into all of the intricate dynamics of that competition here in this conversation.
And how does Tesla's approach of having an AI solution potentially turn this whole thing upside down? So let's go ahead and get into the conversation. The other piece of that strategy is, and I want to talk a little bit on autonomous too, because I'm curious to see how that plays into Wright's law and that curve, right? So one of the advantages of flooding the market with cheaper Teslas in this case, or affordable electric vehicles with a company that can offer autonomy, is that now you're maximizing the number of potentially autonomous vehicles on the road. And you're basically selling the hardware as cheap as you can make it. It's almost like a printer, right? You're trying to flood the market with printers, and then you're going to charge for the ink, in this case, the self-driving software. And that's another variable. How does that work does that break Wright's law? Because the way I think about it is, once you yank the driver out of the equation, the cost per mile plummets, right? The driver is the highest percentage of the cost of, let's say, a transportation unit in a either through hailing a taxi or a rideshare service, or by just or simply by just spending time behind the wheel, your own precious time and the opportunity costs that come from that. So how does that impact Wright's law? How are you guys looking at that? Is this another thing where you flood the market with electric vehicles, there's going to be so much demand for them, you're just going to bring this sort of cost decrease forward, or does it just break the model completely? Help me understand that.
Yeah, and this is Tasha Keeney's work. This is her bread and butter. I know she's been on before. I'm sure you'll have some conversations after 1010 as well. I think it's a different curve altogether. Right? Because it's like if you're looking at dollar per horsepower, that's no longer the performance metric that is worth looking at. And so you switch to a cost per mile basis. And maybe there is a interesting Wright's law curve to be done. You go back in history and you go, what did it cost to go a mile? And where is it going to wind up? We haven't done that. But to your point, I think it's fundamentally a different model altogether. You strip out the driver, it's much less expensive. And the other element, less expensive, higher utilization.
Yeah, potentially it may even reduce the rate of growth of the cars. It's a little complicated because if they become the
monopoly,
I think it balloons at first, but ultimately the car fleet will reduce, right? Or not.
So this is like what I'm struggling with, right? If the cost per mile goes from whatever it is now, $1.50, $1.20, just named, like if an Uber is $2 a mile, but let's say like somebody just buying a used car and paying for gas and paying for maintenance and whatever, it's probably closer to $1.30, $1.40, or maybe even less than that, but yank the driver out of there. All of a sudden, you're essentially cutting the cost of per mile by half. Okay. What does that do to TAM? That to me doesn't feel like a doubling of TAM. That to me feels like a 10xing of TAM. Because now you're opening up, how many people right now can't even afford to buy a car? They have to take public transportation. How many people don't even go anywhere with a car because they can't afford it? How many people carpool? How many people have to stretch very thin to go to work and that's the only thing they can do? How many people try to prevent as many trips outside of the house because gas is expensive? And then you apply markets outside of, let's say, United States, China, into expanding markets, the second and third markets in the world. Like to me, over time, 20 years down the road, the amount of people that are going to be moving around feels a lot more than the number of vehicles that exist today. So if we say there is 1 billion cars in the global fleet, is that the right number? Was it 1 billion or something?
That's 2 billion. No, okay. 2. Yeah.
To me, it feels like that number is going to be higher to serve the want and the need of humans to want to move around. at a fraction of the cost that it costs now, with much more luxury, privacy, entertainment, right? This is just my high level thinking. It's a gut feel thing, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think you're dumb, and I'll tell you why.
Thank you.
No, so you're actually on the right track. The omission there is that I think stuff has an even higher amount of elasticity than people. That, and we're talking about the elasticity of demand, that without a driver in the car, I think the unit economics of transporting goods in a car form factor probably approaches one of the lower form, like maybe approaches trucking, commercial trucking. And without a driver in the truck, the unit economics of transporting goods in a truck approaches train or freight. And so you really start talking about all of your DoorDash and FedEx and parcel delivery and all these types of services, like the unit economics on those undergoes a phase shift, a discontinuous phase shift, and the elasticity of demand on that is huge. And you're layering that on top of the demand for people to move around from place to place. And yeah, I just think that the stuff side of the equation ends up being a larger factor than just the people.
And then I'll just throw in some other cross currents here, which I think make it so difficult to know what's going to happen. Again, right, Tasha's work, there's going to be increased traffic, right? So more cars on the road, even though they're more highly utilized. I think, Hans, you make great points, right? Can it start competing with rail even or something and say, instead of going yard to yard, it's now going door to door? Or the other demand factor, right? Why are you taking a plane to Boston or a train from New York to Boston? It's like, get in a nice autonomous car. You've got worse traffic. Maybe it's less painful because you're chilling in a beautiful autonomous car, taking your cars, making podcasts on the road. And so it's fine. But then maybe there's a premium on getting somewhere, right? And then it's like, what does that look like? Is it all of a sudden, you know, biking is a great opportunity because all the roads are packed with autonomous cars of people who are okay taking their time getting somewhere. But it's like, oh, I actually need to be here in person. So I got to get on a little scooter and get myself there. I think it's going to be a very interesting future.
And it's very difficult to actually see the dynamic of it, because if a lot more people are going to use autonomous vehicles, then a lot fewer people are going to want to own vehicles. So if ownership of vehicles collapse, and maybe autonomous vehicles take their place, is that more vehicles, or is the more efficient use of vehicles mean it's less vehicles? But autonomous vehicles will probably go on the road slower and more sedately than the current. It's very complicated. And then the confounders are even more important here than the trends.
I would even argue that the ownership of vehicles, it doesn't necessarily go down. Because if the ownership of having a self-driving transport with costs of batteries coming down, like most of the savings from a battery perspective and a manufacturing perspective for EVs are far into the future. We still have 20, 40 years, 60 years to go of this technology dropping in price dramatically, right? So if owning a self-driving car is $50 a month, $100 a month, whatever that is that really going to decrease the amount of people that are going to want to have a car that they have? For example, I use the smartphone as an example, right? How many people would pay $1,000 to have a supercomputer in their pocket in the year 2000? That market didn't exist. Now that having a supercomputer is affordable enough, freaking everybody has one, right? Why doesn't that apply to a thing that's giving you the ability to go literally anywhere for almost nothing per mile?
We can calculate that out because there are 30 million EVs sold a year. Is that roughly the right number? I think it is, just from memory.
I think that's cumulative.
Yeah, that was cumulative. I think last year was roughly 10. This year,
we're 10. So to get to the current level of sales of vehicles, you'd have to, it would be a 20, almost 20x, maybe 15 to 20x where they are right now. So that's, how many doublings is that, Sam? You must be so familiar with this math. That's probably six doublings. Is that right?
Let's see, 16, 32.
No, it's many more.
Four to five. Oh, yeah, many more.
No, many more, because we're at millions. we have to get to almost 10 times. So maybe, yeah, so the price is going to 4% times 6, 9, really? It's anyway, you can do the math and you can come up with a number. I don't know. Maybe you're right, but then why buy a car if you can just, you know, hire a car for 50 cents or whatever a mile?
Because at some point, if it's so cheap to own something, why lease it? Apply that to just what we own, right? If what's the difference between owning something for $100 and paying $2 a month for 5 years? Just buy the damn thing for $100. Like, a firm exists for Amazon, as an example, right? People can have a payment plan for whatever, 6 months on a $100 item, but most people just buy the damn thing. So once you reach a level of affordability, I feel like the product just gets purchased. Again, this is just me. I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Sounds like a really great exercise for some economist to figure out. It sounds like something you should do, Sam.
I'd ask for all of you, what's like the key question that keeps you, you're like, wow, this is a great question that I need to get to the answer of, and I don't know, and I think it's important with respect to electric or autonomous?
The question I always ask myself is like, what will people, or what will the economy look like when the cost to move around is less than half? Like, what are the new markets, new industries, new behaviors, new trends? Once a lot of us live in a very privileged society where our ability to move from point A to point B is not really like, we can, when we decide to do it, we do it, right? But not a lot of people have that luxury. Like, I would say that's a luxury that only a few of us have within, especially within the total global context, 8 billion people. What percentage of people can afford to go anywhere anytime they want? It's very little, right? So what happens when you do that? What happens when those floodgates open, which is enabled by dramatically reducing the cost of manufacturing a self-driving unit, plus removing the driver, effectively making the cost per mile pennies on the dollar. That's what keeps me up at night, because that's what the future is going to look like. And it's more far-reaching than just cheaper vehicles or autonomous vehicles existing. It's how we interface with the physical world changes forever. That's what keeps me up at night in a good way.
Who's going to build the roads for that kind of traffic? Not the U.S. road builders. They haven't been...
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
I guess that raises just a quick question for Sam. I'm curious if y'all track closely the autonomous delivery drone space, people like Zipline and whatever Amazon is tracking.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, Larry just said it, but yeah, this is Tasha. Tasha focuses on autonomous, so she's on top of all of the drone delivery companies.
Regulation.
The FAA.
But I would say the FAA, we've got certain other problems currently ongoing for much larger flying vehicles. But I would say it's like the US is slowly picking up steam. The key there being beyond visual line of sight. You go back a handful of years and it was largely outside of the US where that was taking place. US is starting to get on board with that. And we're seeing demonstrations and launches in various places in the US.
So if we're looking at the doubling and the halving, or the doubling and the 15%, I shouldn't say halving, then in the United States, it is quite feasible that we'll see another doubling in 4 or 5 years. And so another 15% reduction in price. So it looks like the price curve meets the ICE vehicle within 5 years. Is that reasonable statement?
I think before then. And this goes back to, one, this is global. Two, what's the performance metric? And like, three, what's the actual vehicle? So it's for, we never said it. I kept on kicking it down the road because it is a less intuitive thing. But at least what we look at is dollar per charging rate. And the reason that we do that for electric vehicles is that the charging rate encompasses a lot of things, right? You get the range of the vehicle because size of the battery matters. You get power electronics get put in there because if you've got poor power electronics, you're not charging that quickly. And that also means you don't have performance on the road either. And it also incorporates your charging infrastructure because there's stuff to be done on that side as well. And it's actually quite useful for seeing who's making compelling vehicles for the cost that's out there. It's less intuitive than to draw it back and say, okay, this is what a vehicle looks like. But it's, could you have a $25,000 200-mile range vehicle, which by all means on paper should be an amazing vehicle that everyone would buy? Yes, is the reality that no one's going to touch it in the US because it's not an SUV and it doesn't go 400 miles. That's also probably true.
Did you evaluate dollars per kilogram mile as a metric?
So kilogram mile fits into the range side of it as well. So I think we didn't look at that.
It sounds like they might be very closely correlated metric.
If that's much shorter cycle, and then if you look at the price of the three, and then in 3 years' time, you're talking about the three-level quality vehicle being in the $25,000 category. It's very hard to see how, I'm looking at China right now and I'm looking at Europe, and it's very hard to see what the outcome is of the collapse of the auto industry as a whole, because it doesn't seem that it can support this kind of competition, or it just seems that we're at a, there's going to be a break point, not a gradual change of, you know, from one to the other, because the auto industry doesn't seem to have been able to keep up.
Yeah, I think consolidation is going to happen. And I think we're already starting to see the first stages of that. You get all these partnerships and it's like those partnerships tend not to work out. And then one player, the one that's chosen, is the last one standing. But yeah, I think there's going to be consolidation down the road. It seems quite likely just given the current trajectories and trends. And then the other thing that I always say is that I think the shift from human-driven gas to autonomous electric is a secular shift, yes, but the auto industry is certainly cyclical, right? And those two overlapping can confuse people, because if you're in a cyclical downturn, instead of a rising tide lifts all boats, a tide going out lowers all boats. But that's also times of transition are often when people are willing to make changes, or companies are. So we'll see what happens.
But when horse buggies, automobiles came about, the transition was incredibly short. It was 5 to 10 years, and every horse buggy manufacturer went out of, every single one of them went out of business. And the survivors of the nascent, of the up and coming auto industry was only two or three players out of what were 100 to 200 different startups. There were only three real survivors, but in the short term, there were about 15 or 20. So if you go to our history, none of the auto companies are going to survive. The successful players will be new players like BYD as an example, but Tesla and Rivian, and as unlikely as it sounds, Lucid possibly. But they may go out of business, or there may be combinations. But it doesn't sound like the auto, if the history is anything to go by, the auto industry doesn't survive.
Wow. IP auto industry. You heard it from Larry. He's already mourning.
I tend to agree with that statement too. For me, it's just a matter of time. It's a combination of culture. It's a combination of just an embedded company that has been around for 100+ years. It's just not going to move quickly. And then especially when they are faced with a transition that takes potentially a decade or two to fully manifest. So you're already not willing to change. And then once the player is working at it for 10, 20 years and you're faced with the inevitable, you can't just, okay, we'll do it now. No, you got to work for 10, 20 years to get to that point. And by then they've already scaled up and they've eaten your lunch. It's not when the iPhone came around and Nokia and all those guys got destroyed. I would argue it's a lot harder to make, for a fact, it's way harder to make millions of cars than it is to make millions of phones. So how quickly that technology gets adopted is different because of how difficult it is to make. And we've been saying it for a while, right? Legacy auto is in huge trouble. It just takes a while.
And it's a progressive technology transition too, because it's not, like you said, it's EV plus autonomy. And we haven't really, like, the autonomy part of the transition hasn't fully been executed technologically yet. And so that is another thing that prevents it from happening super, super quickly. But yeah, like when you look at all the legacy auto manufacturers, they are, you know, they all use waterfall project planning. How does a company like that adopt autonomous software? Like, I just don't understand how that's even possible. And yeah, how do they keep up in a world where a core part of the definition of their product is now most technologically software sophisticated product on the planet?
Sam, I want to be conscious of your time. We've been on for an hour. Are you, what's your limit here?
I can keep going. I cleared, I did a longer hold. Larry prepared me. He said,
ooh.
He said, give it time. So I can stay on for a bit more here.
So I want to just tell you about BlackBerry, Sony, Ericsson, Nokia. Between those four, they controlled 85 to 90% of the hand of the phone industry. Those companies died in a five-year period after the introduction of the iPhone. So I think that we're going to see the demise of the auto OEMs in a very short period, probably 5 years from now, if what Sam says is true about the rate of doubling.
And I think the business model too, that's underappreciated. And this, again, this goes back to the earlier days of why is it so hard to compete with a existing OEM? And it's because they sell their cars essentially for free, and then they make profit on service.
Right.
And if all of a sudden you've got a car that's less expensive than a gas-powered car, and it requires less service, that's quite devastating to that business model.
Right. And that's why the Chinese, we're at a point of crisis for the Chinese dealership network, a true point of crisis. The Chinese government are stepping in. I don't know what they'll do, because if they try and shore it up, they'll go down. The government will go down with the dealership. They can't keep shelling out that kind of money every month or every year. So what happens in the US where the government is not going to step in to save the dealerships, right?
They have before. Not the dealerships, but the...
That's the point I'm trying to make. So if they try and step in to save the car manufacturer, really, I don't think there's enough money in the United States to do that.
I wouldn't underestimate the power of the dealership lobby, though. I do agree that it doesn't have nearly as big of a stranglehold on the federal government as the auto manufacturers themselves do. And one of the things that's working against the dealership network as well in the US is that, you know, damn, the auto manufacturers would love to shed the dealership network. Ford, GM, everybody here would love to shed that network, because that all that network does is add a markup that shouldn't be there, which traditionally has been there to protect the consumer so that they have competition and it drives prices lower and you have a place where you can go get your car fixed. But it has done literally exactly the opposite in today's day and age. It's just a tool for a group of people to extract money out of the system through the unwillingness of being transparent about pricing. That's what the dealership network is, right? And so if the auto manufacturers, the legacy manufacturers are going to say, okay, we have players coming in that are dramatically lowering the cost, and we know this entire body is trying to siphon as many dollars as it can out of our product, then I bet you they'll do whatever they need to do to kick them out. So I agree with you. I do think there's going to be a dynamic at play here where the dealership lobby is actually going to be, there's a forcing function to remove them from the equation. If the legacy automakers understand that equation is it's one of the variables why they're uncompetitive, right? Plus the fact that they don't have the right culture, plus the fact that they're slow, plus the fact that they have all these assets from a manufacturing perspective that build the previous technology, plus they don't know how to build a new technology, et cetera, right?
Farzad, are you planning to open a dealership?
Come in to Farzad's dealership. We offer $500 off for veterans and people who like cars. Come on in.
Yeah. So can I tell you what's happened to German dealerships? So the German car manufacturing industry, which is at the kind of point we're pointing to for the US industry in 2 or 3 years' time, they're in terrible crisis, and they're functionally closing their dealers down as dealers. They're giving them a small commission on the sale of the cars, and they're starting to sell the cars direct. It's easier for them because there are a huge number of contractual buyers. Many cars, a very high percentage of cars in Germany, are sold to firms who then lease them to their employees. So the dealerships are being cut out and they're remaining as service dealers, if you wish. And that's what's happening in Germany. If it happens in Germany, how's it not going to happen in the United States? How's that not going to be the way that the US OEMs are going to have to go? So we're seeing this crisis point. We're seeing this break point happening in Germany. And it's happening there first because the Germans have been so, you know, so head in the sand about their cars. They've been manufacturing these incredibly expensive cars and China's closed them down now. And so they're in trouble, serious trouble.
Hans, jump in here. I saw you unmute a few times.
It was really on a previous or an unrelated tangent. So I'll let Larry keep going on dealers.
I'm done. I've made my point.
I could definitely see dealerships being a sacrificial lamb in all of this. The moving back to a higher level, the question in my mind is, it's easy to put a company like Uber and think of them in competition to robo-taxis and think, man, they're just not going to be competitive with Tesla long-term. They're just at a disadvantage to Tesla in that space. But then if you think about this collapsing auto market and think about the advantages that they have in whatever this new form of transport ends up being compared to the legacy automakers, then it starts to be a little bit more interesting. And like we continue to see them trying to partner with anyone and everyone that they can who's doing anything related to autonomous driving. And they have an incredible apparatus that is very adept at working with regulators in a distributed and at scale way. And they understand operations at scale. They could potentially transition into fleet management at scale, and they're a software first company. So I guess my question is, and whether it's them or whether it's Google or whether it's some other player, is there a third party entrant in the autonomous EV market that seems to be a better alternative for survival in that world than any of the direct manufacturers who are not able to keep up with the autonomous driving capability in-house?
As far as I go for it, and then I'll jump in.
I was going to give it to you.
Okay. But yeah, so it's like, why do I think it makes sense for Uber to team up with Waymo and whoever they can is because of the peak trough nature of demand for rides, right? So it's like people aren't going places when everyone just got to work, but tons of people are traveling to work at the same time. And so for someone like Tesla, who has people who can lease their cars into the fleet, it's like Tesla can have a small portion of vehicles that are highly utilized across the peak trough. And then when they need extra drivers to meet the peak, they can incentivize drivers to say, hey, put your car into the robo-taxi network and that'll solve it. It's like if you look at someone like Waymo, what are they going to do? It's like they either have enough vehicles themselves to handle both the peak and the baseload, in which case that's on their balance sheet. And that's a ton of vehicles that are way underutilized because they need to meet peak. But really, the bulk of it is going to be baseload. And so that's a difficult spot. And since they don't have that user base, they need someone like Uber to say, hey, for this to make sense, let's have a baseload amount. And then we need drivers to come in during those peak times. I think my read for Uber, and again, this is discussions with Tasha as well for her thoughts here, is they're not, it's like, what is their expertise? Sourcing drivers. I think people give too much credit to the complication. It's like sourcing drivers is probably like the biggest thing. And then they've got a lot of other complicated things with restaurants and Uber Eats and all of those types of things. But it's, I think the actual taxi portion of it, if you don't need to source drivers and there's demand because you're undercutting, is probably not as difficult as people think. The question then is, yeah, what you just said at the end there is, who can come in and do this? And it's, does Uber have expertise in servicing a giant fleet? Are they any better than Hertz? It's like Hertz actually has to repair their cars themselves. Insurance companies don't know that all this work's been done on a car, right? I'm not sure that Uber has that same level of expertise. But I do think that there is going to be this opportunity for a fleet manager to come in and get a return on capital doing something like that.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I think the thing that I get stuck with on a Uber type or even a Waymo type is when you have a player that in theory is going to be able to manufacture millions of units of self-driving vehicles at a cost per unit that's significantly less than the competition, and that player has an app already, what's the purpose of? I don't get it. I literally don't get the purpose of Uber in that world. You already have the product you're going to be offering is going to be less just because the cost to manufacture the thing is going to be significantly less than everybody else. You bypass the Uber markup because the company is going direct to the consumer. It's like the Uber is like a dealership network of self-driving cars. You're adding your markup for what reason? So that they can collect money to connect the driverless car to a person. Okay, so that guy, Tesla in this case, can already do that. And then the third one is Uber already has a network of people that drive cars. And now they're going to look to add products that are self-driving that if they want to compete with the player that's going direct to the consumer with cars that are much cheaper per mile, all of a sudden, they're going to have to make a decision. Do we undercut every other person on our network, or do we offer it for a similar price and justify it as you're getting more stuff, you're getting luxury, you're getting privacy, you're going to get the sound system, you can play with it. But your competitor in Tesla, in this case, already is going to offer it for way less per mile because of their scale, and they're going to have all those bonuses as well. That's where I don't understand Uber in that scenario. In a world where Tesla can manufacture millions of units per year at $20,000 to $25,000 per unit with their self-driving suite with cameras and an inference computer, I just don't see Uber surviving.
They just need to do it.
They just need to do it. Exactly.
They need to do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, but if you assume that Tesla's not 100% of vehicle manufacturing and there are other vehicles that are not Tesla that are on the road, and those other manufacturers who are making those vehicles don't also have an app, then there's a need for something like that.
Yeah, maybe it's like the Rebel. It's like the Rebel Alliance is all the other, because I think one way to frame it right now, Tesla's revenue is every other autonomous company's cost. So Tesla's getting all of these millions and billions of miles because people are paying for it. And that's great. They collect that revenue and then we all go about and drive. For Waymo to get that, they need to spend money because no one's buying their cars. They're buying it themselves. So it's maybe you have all of those companies who can't scale as effectively. They all partner up and they need Uber as that higher level aggregator in order to make it functional. I think that could be a plausible case. I don't know how successful it would be, but that seems like a
so the pitch. Comma AI app will be the one that kills all of the things that don't get killed by the Tesla app.
Have you used the Comma AI stuff?
No, I haven't.
Yeah.
I follow it, but yeah, I haven't used it yet.
And how does that conglomerate, in what world can it be price competitive? Like, that's where I keep getting stuck, is like the formula just doesn't work.
Let me ask a tough question. Let's assume Tesla doesn't achieve autonomy for another year and a half. I know that's outside everybody's calculus right now. Everybody in the Tesla world is outside their calculus. But if they don't achieve it in another year and a half, where will Waymo / Uber be in their journey? And will their costs collapse to a point where they can actually compete effectively with Tesla?
I think the question's vastly different if based on if one believes if an end-to-end neural network is the right solution to solve for self-driving, right? That's the driver, I think. If the answer is no, then Tesla's fucked, okay? Because they've spent all these billions of dollars. Good thing I can curse on my own podcast. They spent all these billions of dollars into this dead end. If it doesn't work, they basically have to restart from square one. Their entire manufacturing process has to be different. They have to essentially have to deal with an entire fleet of cars that are owned by people who were under the assumption that they could at least in some respects add it to a fleet and earn money. They're going to have to deal with that hot mess, right? It becomes a disaster. The valuation of the company probably tanks. So then forget it. They're completely removed from the equation. But if they can solve it with end-to-end neural net, then the opposite is true, is that what other player has invested the training compute and the inference compute and the data collection that gets them anywhere close to what Tesla has done? So it's a tale of two extremes for me. And Ark has talked about this. Elon's talked about this. It's a tale of two extremes. You're either dead in the water or you have a gigantic advantage, right? So to me, is even if they don't achieve it within a year and a half, but it's still the right answer, you're just delaying the inevitable, which is a giant head start. It's just the amount of time it's taken to get to that giant head start is longer. Somebody tell me why I'm in Hans's words.
I tend to agree, but I'll take devil's advocate to make it interesting. Why not? But it's right. It's let's say Waymo can successfully get to all of the major cities and let's say it's three years. And at that point, their car, instead of costing, I actually don't know what the most recent price of the vehicle for their new one is, but it's, let's say they get it down 100K. Let's say they get it down to 50K instead. Then it's maybe they can offer compelling rides and they've got enough users on it. And then the question is, how much profit is on the table for another player? But it is a weak case here because I do agree. It's like Tesla, in theory, should be able to come in at a lower price point and then shift people over. I think the surprising thing, maybe not that surprising, but it was a debate for a while, is like Uber and Lyft. It's all, what's differentiating the two? Is it winner take most? Is it not? And it's for a while, there was good competition. But largely, it seems as though it's just Uber. And so that's an interesting thing. Is it winner take all or is it not? Can you carve out certain geographies or something like that? But it's a weak case here, Farzad. I agree with what you said.
Well, as far as Uber is concerned, it has been winner take all. They've won in certain geographies, but definitely other companies have won in other geographies. If I go to depends on where you are in Europe. It's different winners in each of those geographies. And certainly China's a very different case. So who knows? I mean, several Chinese companies say they've made the breakthrough and they're doing it, and they're doing it with very relatively inexpensive vehicles, electric vehicles, and, you know, claiming they're winning. So I think it's going to be interesting. I think if Tesla does take another year and a half, I think it'll be more difficult than if they're able to solve it in 2025, as I've been thinking they will. So time will tell.
So let me ask you a question there. Sorry, Hans, go ahead.
I would go back to, Sam's earlier point about the peak to trough challenge. And for whichever player is more hardware constrained, assuming that's Waymo or whoever else, that challenge is a much harder challenge to meet. And then the ability to pull from consumer owned vehicles on a as needed basis. Like, that is Tesla's core advantage in a robo-taxi network, is that they can have a combination of fleet owned baseload supply and then that as needed consumer owned surplus that they can pull from to satisfy that peak demand. And I think that is an advantage that long-term, regardless of geography, I don't understand how you out-compete that without having something similar. And I don't see players besides Chinese players who look to be on a path to do that.
Yeah. They can make 10 to 100 to 1,000x more per year, per whatever time scale you want to use, at a cheaper cost. Any problem that you face from a fleet management perspective, a supply demand perspective, a like price to price perspective, both variables are in the advantage of Tesla. Again, as long as they can figure out how to make this vision stack work. If they make the vision stack work, I have a very hard time understanding how it's anything but winner takes all.
The bottlenecks end up being not technological or business model ones, but political ones.
Correct. Which could be why Mr. Elon Musk is getting a little bit more political lately.
But I can give you a very strong argument against Tesla network being as elastic in demand as you put it, because people who own cars for the purpose of putting them in the fleet are not going to be happy just supplying that peak, the peak hours. Completely destroys their economics. if they own the car for their own use, they're the people who will be using it at peak time, just like everybody else. So I think this whole idea of Tesla owners are going to shove their car in at peak hours is, I think it's as fallacious as any other argument. I think time will tell, but if I own a, pardon?
I disagree.
Okay.
Here's, as far as I tell me, this is my response. I would want pushback, or if this is what you think. People right now offer their cars at peak time. Uber drivers, they do it. They, except for they're sitting in the car. They are sitting in a car that they own at peak hours, driving other people around for not a lot of money. It seems then that those people would also be willing to do the exact same thing, but not have to sit in the car.
And perfect. And the additional variable, exactly. So they're not only putting their car at harm's in harm's way, they're putting themselves in harm's way. So what's safer, you being in a car with a rando or you not being in the car with a rando? And if you can make passive income instead of active income, why wouldn't you do passive income? The other, so that's beautiful, Sam. And then the other thing I would also add on top of that is, okay, so let's say the adding the owner's cars into the fleet during peak trough, if you're having a challenge meeting that demand, what is the net number of cars truly that would fit into that equation? In any given city, let's say Austin, Texas, how many Uber drivers are available at 10 o'clock or 2 a.m. or 1 a.m. on a Saturday night? 10,000? 20,000? That's like what? Like half a week of Tesla's production? So you're telling me that you can't produce, just Tesla puts them there. It takes them a couple of weeks. Problem solved, right? So these are like, that's the way I view it, is these are not really problems. They're problems in a world where we have to employ drivers. And they're problems in a world where you can't make millions of units per year. They're not problems in a world where you can do that.
I think the game theory on this is very difficult, but at this point, I unfortunately do have to say goodbye.
Okay. Last, can I ask a last question?
Yeah.
Our answer to this is already out there. It's in our open source model. So if you're interested in ARC's take on this, but each one of you, what is, when's the launch of a commercial Tesla robo-taxi, and what's your confidence interval?
Can you define what is the scale of the release that you would...
You self-define your launch.
Okay. I guess since I'm stupidly raised my hand to answer it now first. So I think that it's likely that they're already trialing the robo-taxi service with drivers in-house somewhere with Tesla employees only. That said, I don't think that we're going to really be ready for commercial scale rollout of, I don't know, it's hard for me. I want to take the bearish side of the 2 years, but I just, it's almost impossible for me to conceive that there is not one single township, whether it's Austin, San Francisco, LA, Chandler, Arizona, Miami, where they do not have a network that is operating at least at level 2 and they have drivers in it within the next 18 months.
That's so bearish. Okay. My prediction is that they'll have a unit, a transportation unit without a driver that will collect a fare from point A to point B from a human being in the car without a driver needing to be in the car by July of 2025.
So I'm going to be a lot more specific. I think that my guess is that there will be autonomous driverless vehicles on offer by Tesla by December of next year. For the end of the year next year, their first rides will be available.
So what was ARC's answer?
So we have the Monte Carlo simulation. So we've got percentages, but these are the percent of simulations where they commercialize. 58% of those were in 2025, 38% were in 2026, and 4% in 2027. So obviously there's a tail after that that goes out, but you can see the bulk of simulations suggest in the next couple of years.
May or may not have peaked at that before I get my answer.
Cheater. All right. Sam, where can people find you? Where can people find ARC's research?
Yeah, you can harass me on Twitter or on X, my apologies, at @scorusarc. And people should go to arc-invest.com if they want to read our research.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Sam, for making the time. Thank you, Larry, for creating the beautiful conversation here. And thank you, Hans, obviously, as my co-host. We'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye. And then we'll shout out Chamath. He's on Joe Rogan today. All right, end recording.